Good afternoon, everyone. I think it's time to start. My name is Richard Derrick. I am recruited out of the audience to introduce Pierre, but I actually have a relation here. I am the vice chair of the Committee on the Theory of Risk of the CAS, and that committee is charged with the duty of awarding a prize for the best research paper published in the American Risk and Insurance Association journals. Those journals are the Journal of Risk and Insurance and Risk Management Insurance Review. That process has been going on way before I've been involved, and there has been an association between the CAS and the American Risk and Insurance Association through this particular prize award and in cooperation on various issues of common interest. This year, as with previous years, there are nominations that are made from the entire list of publications during the year, and there is a distinguished group of academics and members of the CAS who review the papers, suggest finalists, and then there's a runoff. And I'm happy to say we were able to reach a conclusion, and the conclusion was Pierre Picard, and we're very happy to have him here at the CAS meeting to deliver the paper. One additional fact that might be of interest to you is the American Risk and Insurance Association also awards a prize for the best paper in the Journal of Risk and Insurance. Same process, different people, and this year they came to exactly the same conclusion. So Pierre Picard is not only a winner of this prize, but he's a double winner as a twofer for the same paper. The recollection of older folk like me and others cannot even remember a time when both groups, the professors and the actuaries, agreed on exactly the same thing to award the best paper prize for. So I hope you're going to enjoy this, and introducing Pierre Picard, lately of Paris. And Pierre has promised that the best question he gets a free trip to Paris.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's always a pleasure to have you in Paris, by the way. It has been really a great honor for me to receive this award at the Providence ARIA meeting in late August, and it's a true pleasure for me to be here for this presentation. This is a paper, as mentioned in the title, about natural disaster insurance. As we all know, the problem of natural disaster becomes even more and more important, particularly, in this new era of global warming and all the problem of natural catastrophes, which seems to become more and more frequent and more important. In the title, there are two words, equity and efficiency, which are very frequently, in a sense, not really opposed in the economic literature, but which appears as competing goals. We would like an economic policy to be fair, but we would like also it to be efficient. Well, it really depends on which framework, in which setting this opposition trade-off, let's say, appears, but it's certainly something which is quite important when we have in mind how natural disasters the risk associated with natural disasters can be managed. So this is, the topic of this paper, I would say, is a reflection on this general idea. Let me first start with a few words about the general idea of this paper and the motivation for this paper. Well, first of all, we all know that the insurance industry may contribute, I would say, to the management of natural disaster risk in various ways. There are, of course, the standard risk pooling mechanism, which is the core of insurance, of course, but also transferring risk, which is particularly important for catastrophe risk, as we know, particularly because of the correlation of risk, which makes the pooling mechanism more difficult and less efficient. So transferring risk through reinsurance or alternative risk transfers. Well, besides this, I would say this usual and or standard contribution of insurance to the risk management of natural disasters, insurers may also, would say, contribute to the fight against natural disaster in terms of prevention or mitigation in various ways. And first of all, of course, by assessing risk, providing information on risk exposure, which is something which is quite important and which is a role of one of the roles of insurance. But also, and this is the purpose of this paper, insurers can also provide incentives for prevention or mitigation through price signals. Well, this is something which is, of course, important for not only for natural disasters, but for also for many risks. But this is particularly important for the coverage of natural disaster losses. That can be done in various ways, in particular by charging risk-adjusted premiums. And I here give some examples. For example, when a property developer or a businessman consider a natural disaster risk associated to his business, it's quite important to have in mind the true price of risk, and this is something that insurance contracts, of course, provide. This is true for many aspects of activities which are for which there is a part of natural disaster risk. Once we have that in mind, we immediately think that, mitigating natural disaster risk through insurance or preventing natural disaster risk through insurance pricing is quite difficult. And it's quite difficult for various reasons. And I just here mention a couple of them. You may, of course, have in mind other reasons. For example, people, be they individuals or corporations, and particularly individuals, they may prefer to rely on post-disaster assistance from governments or from non-governmental organizations rather than purchasing insurance, which may be very costly. And this is, of course, particularly important for poor people or poor countries. Well, the second reason which has been frequently put forward is related to the imperfect information about risk that and about the loss probabilities that people may have. And in particular, they may underestimate their true loss probability. While the third reason, which is mentioned here, is about the difficulty for low-income consumers to afford insurance. And the fourth reason, is related to adverse selection problems, hidden information, which may have as a consequence the fact that the burden may be concentrated on high-risk individuals, why low-risk individuals who may also be at risk, they may prefer not to purchase any insurance coverage because of this adverse selection problem, because they are mixed with people who may have higher risk, may incur higher risk. So anyway, whatever these difficulties, which are obviously quite important, well, using insurance pricing, well, is quite important because, well, it relies, I would say, on the forces of incentives, which may be considered in many fields, and in particular in this one, it may be more effective than a pure command and control approach. Well, there is this dilemma that I would like to analyze in this presentation between incentives and fairness. As I said, this dilemma, I would say, is widespread in many issues related to economic policy. But this is particularly important for the topics that we are going to analyze here. The dilemma between, on one side, incentives that should be provided to individuals, to corporations, and even to governments or to communities through actuarial insurance premiums, through premiums which are risk-based. If you are more at risk, you should pay more. And that provides you incentives for mitigating risk, for preventing risk if you can. And on the other side, there is a fairness objective, the fact that an economic policy should be fair. In particular, what does that mean? Well, we should be clear on what I have in mind here. What I have in mind is the fact that there are many people who are not in position to reduce their risk exposure at reasonable cost. For some people or for some firms, that's something which is possible. It is a part of, I would say, of an economic calculation. For other people, that may be very costly or quite impossible. And the issue, in fact, which will be quite important in this presentation, is the fact that this cost of reducing risk, in fact, is very often a private information, something which is not publicly known to everybody, and particularly not publicly known to regulators, to governments. This is something which is an hidden information. Well, these two conflicting objectives, we may find them in various examples of regulated insurance markets for natural disasters, and particularly in the US, the NFIP, some features of the NFIP are particularly illustrative of these two conflicting objectives. On one side, providing flood insurance at affordable price, and on the other side, sending clear signals to property owners through risk-based insurance premiums. And in particular, well, once we have in mind the fact that there is a dilemma and a trade-offs where we have to make choices, something which is, of course, quite important is how we can improve this trade-off. It's one thing to recognize that there is a trade-off. That does not mean that we cannot do anything. That means that an efficient economic policy, I would say an adequate economic policy, should try to improve the terms of this trade-off. And for example, just to give a quite straightforward example, charging full risk premiums for new buildings and subsidized premiums for older buildings, which is a characteristic of the NFIP, well, that makes sense. In particular, it's not because we want to make to better treat by itself people who own old houses or old buildings. It makes sense, in fact, because probably the distribution of prevention cost is not the same for these two kind of buildings. And probably the distribution of prevention cost is something which is randomly distributed among buildings. But this random distribution is probably not the same for all buildings and for new buildings, which means that the terms of the trade-off is probably not the same for the two kinds of buildings. And that's a good reason for treating them differently. Another aspect, which is quite important in the NFIP, and which I will consider also, is related, well, to incentives that should be given to individuals and incentives that should be given to communities, or let's say to local governments or local jurisdictions. Well, there is an important relationship between these two kinds of incentives in the NFIP, particularly through the community rating system. And as we'll see, well, these two kinds of incentives are strongly, in fact, in, I would say from an abstract point of view, from a theoretical point of view, they are strongly related. We cannot separate them. The incentive you give to individuals will affect the incentives of their communities. And the incentives that are given to the communities, for example, by through grants which would be allocated, let's say, by a federal government, will have consequences for individual people. So one of the aspects of the issues I would like to consider is related to this relationship between incentive provided to individuals and incentive provided to communities. Well, I would say on the extreme, on the other extreme of the spectrum of regulated insurance markets for natural disaster, I can take an example I know probably better than others, which is the French natural disasters insurance regime, which is also as an FIP very highly regulated regime, but with strongly different aspects. It strongly focuses on the fairness objective through, in particular, uniform insurance pricing, so without any risk-based premium that could be used as a signal and as an incentive for regulation for prevention. But the consequences are that, well, the performances of this regime have been very poor on the prevention front. Both systems, as many other systems that we have in various countries, in particular in various European countries, well, they rest on something which is not organized in the same way, which is common, which is a solvency guarantee, which is offered by the federal government, let's say. The NFIP has borrowing authority with the US Treasury, and in France, the government guarantees the solvency of a state-owned reinsurer that provides reinsurance without upper limit for natural disaster risk. This state-owned reinsurer is called the CCR, the Caisse Centrale de Réassurance. So whatever the modalities and the ways through which this solvency by the federal or the national government is offered, this is an important aspect of this kind of regulated markets. Keeping these various motivations in mind, of course, I will only focus on some aspects of this program, which is quite wide and which covers a lot of various issues that I will not consider really in this presentation. As I said, I focus on this equity efficiency dilemma, or trade-off as you want, and by asking some simple questions, I would say. The first question is, where does it exactly come from? What is the source of this dilemma precisely, I would say? It's important to understand it if we want to improve the terms of this dilemma. We need to understand what the logic is, in fact, behind it. And the answer I would like to try to propose is the fact that it comes from an asymmetry of information about prevention costs. How can this dilemma or this trade-off be improved? And the answer I will propose is it can be improved through categorization. Categorization of what? Categorization of individuals or categorization of risk areas. And we'll consider that with a very simple model, in fact. The third question is, does this dilemma affect individuals or, well, prevention by individuals or prevention by communities? Well, the answer is, as I already mentioned, is both, in fact. And the fourth question is, should the federal or the central, the national government provide prevention incentives to individuals or to communities? And the answer is both strengthen together, in fact. The incentive you provide to individuals reinforce the incentives of their communities, and symmetrically. Finally, just a few words about some related development in the insurance economics literature. Well, there are a lot of papers which have been written on topics which are related to all these issues. And I just mentioned two areas which are quite important and related to these problems. Which these areas correspond to some kind of theoretical background of these questions. First of all, it is about the restrictions that the government impose on rate classification, and are these restrictions the source of some inefficiency in insurance markets? There has been a wide literature and important literature on these issues, which was initiated in particular by famous papers by Arrow and Polly about community rating in health insurance, and later extended to various and other markets, in particular automobile insurance or annuity markets. And another related area of research is related to the consequences of risk classification that has been developed in various directions, and the effect of risk classification on welfare. Does risk classification improve the efficiency of markets or not? Well, one aspect on these issues is related to private information that people may have on their risk. And there has been contributions, particularly by Croker and Snow, on the fact that, on the idea that, well, once you have this asymmetry of information about risk, you have some inefficiency that enters the picture of the market, but this inefficiency can be not suppressed but reduced if you categorize individuals through observable signals that are correlated with this hidden information. So categorizing individuals through these signals may reduce, in the sense, the inefficiency which are linked to the asymmetry of information. Well, there are also other issues which are more in line with the kind of problem I will consider here, that correspond to, what says, the interference between risk classification and decision of individuals, for example, to look for information about their own risk. Just have to think of genetic testing. And also, and this is related to my presentation, was the interference with the stimulation, the incentives for risk prevention. And also with some adverse equity effect that may follow from this risk classification, particularly, of course, when some individuals have to pay very high premium, which they cannot afford. So I'm going to start by introducing a model. I must say it's a purely theoretical model. You may find it quite unrealistic as a description of insurance markets and the problems that we are considering, which are complex and with very specific aspects which are linked to the various types of natural disaster we may have in mind. This is a very abstract model, a highly simplified model, but I hope to convince you that it may allow us to conceptualize, to better understand this equity efficiency trade-off that I will introduce in the second part. And then, as I mentioned, the important problems, and particularly I would say for actuaries, is how we can improve the trade-off, because improving the trade-off means using information to condition the insurance contract, for example, the premium that we have to pay on this information. and which kind of information that what we are going to see with in mind the fact that the objective is to improve this trade-off between equity and efficiency. Well, in the first part, I focus on individual decision-making, prevention by individuals, and then I will extend to prevention by communities, and considering the relationship between the two kinds of prevention decisions, and I will end with some comments, very brief comments. Let me say that if there is some clarification question, just don't hesitate to ask me, and maybe we will keep time for discussion at the end. So I first introduce what I have presented as a very simple model, as I said, probably a very unrealistic model. Unrealistic in the sense that there are many aspects of natural disaster insurance that are completely ignored, and that will be easy for you to find all these aspects that are completely ignored in this model. So imagine a risk of natural disaster, let's say flood risk, in a country where we may have two types of areas. Some areas are high-risk areas, and in this area, there is, let's say, in a given period of time, let's say in a given year, a probability which is denoted by pi h of a natural disaster, let's say, of a flood. You also have low-risk areas where the probability is lower and is denoted by pi l. And there is a fraction of inhabitants which are initially located in a high-risk area. This fraction is denoted by lambda, so lambda is between 0 and 1. So people who are in high-risk areas, well, they have a higher probability of suffering losses from, let's say, flood than people who are located in low risk. For simplicity, they all have the same initial wealth. This is not really important, which is denoted by W, and they may suffer a loss, and here this is highly simplified. This loss, in case of a flood, let's say, is given. We may consider various size of losses. Here, the most simple model we could imagine, the loss in case of natural disaster, let's say the cost of their building that could be destroyed, is denoted by A. Well, I will focus on risk prevention. We know that there is also the problems of risk mitigation, which could be analyzed along the same way as I'm considering here risk prevention. So I focus on risk prevention, but you easily can adapt the kind of modeling to risk mitigation. So what does it mean? What does it mean here in this model, risk prevention? Well, simply the fact that some people who are living or who are considering living in a high-risk area, well, they may reduce their risk by moving to a low-risk area. If it's a new building, as I said before, they could decide to, initially their preferred location was along a river, let's say, where it was a high-risk area. They may consider, okay, moving and settling down in a low-risk area. Or if it's an old house, which is already in a high-risk area, the person who are living in this house, they may consider moving to a low-risk area. And this is costly, of course. And the cost is denoted by C. So C is a prevention cost. And C, and this is something which will be quite important, C is supposed to be differentiated among the inhabitants of the high-risk areas. And it is private information to each individual. Okay, what does that mean? That means that for some people, it's not very costly to move to another location. Think of a firm which decides to settle down for a new building, let's say. But for other people, that would be more costly. And there are many, many reasons for which this cost of prevention may vary from some people to other ones. And what is quite important is the fact that this information is privately known. People or firms who may take this prevention decisions, they know what is this cost. And this cost is specific to each individual or to each firm which is concerned. It is private information. And this is quite important to have this idea in mind. When people, often it say that behind the problem of natural disaster insurance, there is a problem of adverse selection, the fact that people have some private information about their risk. Well, in fact, it's much more important to think that people have private information about how costly it would be to them to escape from the risk, that information about their risk. You know, for example, that NFIP has developed a lot of very precise maps about the risk. So, of course, this map, precise enough, but they give very, very specific, very precise information about the risk. But how costly is it for people to escape from a given location where they want to settle down or where they used to be, where they used to live from many years ago? That's something which is really an hidden information. So C is a parameter, let's say a monetary parameter, which is specific to each individual. And this is distributed among all the real numbers with some cumulative distribution function, which is denoted by capital F. So capital F of C, well, the probability that for a given individual that his prevention cost is lower than C, and there is a density function FC. Well, people, well, they dislike risk, they would like to be protected against risk, and they are risk averse. So they are expected utility maximizers. So they would like to maximize the expected utility of their final wealth, which is denoted by WF. So U here is a utility function. Well, it's concave in the sense that it means that they are risk averse. They would like to be protected against risk, and that's why they will choose to purchase insurance, if they can afford it, of course. Well, in this model, insurance contracts can be described in very simple, by two very simple parameters. There is a premium, which is denoted by P, how much money you need to pay to be covered, and there is an indemnity, which is denoted by I, let's say if you are affected by a natural disaster. So your final wealth that I have defined, denoted WF, this final wealth, well, it takes two possible values according to whether you have suffered a natural disaster or not. Well, if you have not suffered any natural disaster, well, your final wealth, WF, is just equal to your initial wealth minus your premium that you pay, minus your cost, your prevention cost, if you have incurred this prevention cost. If you don't have incurred any cost because you have chosen to make no prevention, or maybe you are already were living in a low-risk area, in that case, C is equal to zero, of course. But in case of a disaster, well, your initial wealth will be reduced by A, which is the amount, the loss that you have suffered because of this catastrophe. Of course, you have paid your premium, but you receive this indemnity I. Okay? And if you have made this prevention decision, you have also have incurred this cost C. Well, I assume a very simple, one more time, quite unrealistic description of how insurance markets work here. Insurance markets are supposed to be competitive without any transaction cost. Insurers are risk neutrals. Well, we can extend the result to a more realistic framework with premium loadings and a number of things that would give a much more realistic image of insurance markets that would not change really the conclusions of this presentation. Well, now I make the government or the regulator enter the picture. And what can the government do, let's say the federal government do in this situation? Well, It may tax or subsidize insurance contracts, and it may implement this taxation or subsidization, I would say, differently according to the risk exposure. So we may have lump sum tax or lump sum subsidies. Well, lump sum taxes are denoted by TL in low risk areas. Intuitively, in low risk areas, the actuarial premium will be low, of course, because the risk will be low. So, because of some equity considerations, the federal government may consider, let's say, tax this insurance contract in order to subsidize the people who are purchasing insurance in high-risk areas. And the lump sum subsidy is denoted by TH in high-risk areas. So something which is quite important here is the fact that TL and TH, well, they don't depend on the individual prevention cost. And they cannot depend on this prevention cost because, as I said before, this prevention cost is private information. It cannot be observed. So it's impossible to make some kind of tailor-made proposal to individuals telling them, okay, I know that you have suffered this prevention cost, it's okay, or that you are going to suffer this prevention cost if you make this decision, so I compensate you exactly for this amount of money because I know this is the prevention cost you are incurring, and then I offer you this kind of insurance contracts. We offer insurance contract, same for everybody. The only difference which can be introduced in the picture is the fact that these insurance contracts may be subsidized or taxed according to the fact whether it is in a high-risk area or in a low-risk area. So we may have tax cuts or subsidies according to the level of risk. So as I said, insurance market is supposed to be competitive, and so there will be insurance contracts denoted by PLIL in low-risk areas, and insurance contract PHIH in high-risk areas, okay? And well, these three equations here, well, what do they say to us? Well, the two first equations tell us that the premium is the actuarial premium. Keep in mind that we have forgotten any premium loadings up to the transfer, to the lump sum transfer, which may be positive if it is a subsidy or negative if it is a tax. So the cost of the lump sum tax, will be added to the fair premium here. Pi LIL is the fair premium, the actuarial premium, if you prefer, because it's an indemnity multiplied by the probability that there will be a catastrophe. So this is the actuarial premium, and then you add the tax and you get the premium which will emerge from competitive markets. In high-risk areas, premiums are subsidized because of the subsidy TH, which is paid by the federal government. So the true premium will be lower than the actuarial premium, PHIH, because of this subsidy. And finally, because there is no loading here, it's the best thing that insurance can offer to individuals is full coverage, because there is no loading, so no transaction costs in this modeling. So the best contract that insurance market can offer is full coverage, which means that the indemnity in low risk and high risk areas will be equal to losses, A. This is how well insurance market will work in this regulated competitive market. Well, we may, as a departure point, we may consider an allocation that I'll define as an egalitarian allocation. Think, for example, of the situation I mentioned in my introduction about France, where you have a purely uniform insurance pricing, which is regulated by the central government for natural disaster insurance, which means that we would consider that, well, it is a target just taken here as a starting point, that everybody should be put exactly in the same position. Everybody for, let's say, some equity reason, for fairness reason. We'll, of course, come back on this idea in a few moments. Everybody should pay the same premium. So assume that we consider that people who are in low-risk areas, where they should not be penalized because they are living there, and they should pay the same premium as people that who are living in high-risk areas. So we take it as an assumption that PL should be equal to PH. Second equality, of course, that we should introduce is the fact that our federal government, well, he has a budget constraint. Well, there is no outside money which is flowing down, and which means that subsidies should be just paid through tax resources, in fact. So here, there is a proportion of individuals that are denoted by Landau who are living in high-risk areas. So they are supposed to receive a subsidy TH, okay? So the total cost per individual of the subsidies is equal to Landau TH, and this should be equal to the total cost per individual, in fact, would be equal to the total taxes that are levied, in fact, in low-risk areas, which are equal to 1 minus lambda, the proportion of people who are living in low-risk areas, multiplied by the tax, the unique tax. So you have these two equations, and it's easy to compute. It is quite straightforward, in fact. To compute, in fact, what would be this insurance premium that I denote here by P star, which would put people exactly on the same basis for this egalitarian allocation, and what would be, I would say, the redistributive subsidy and tax. Lump sum tax and lump sum subsidies. You solve this equation and you get something which is quite intuitive. P star should be, which is such that it's equal to PL and PH, it's just equal, this is obvious, to some kind of average actuarial premium, because lambda pi H plus 1 minus lambda pi L, what is it? It is just an average probability of suffering a disaster among the whole population. So you multiply by the loss L, A, and then you get the premiums that should be paid by everybody if everybody should be treated in the same way in terms of insurance. And then you compute TH and TL, and this is very simple to do, and you get something which is called TH star and TL star, which gives you how much transfer you should introduce between people who are living in high-risk areas and people who are living in low-risk areas, so that the government budget is balanced. Well, needless to say, in this situation, there is absolutely no prevention. For an obvious reason, nobody has any incentives to make any prevention decision, because prevention is costly, as we have said, and there is absolutely no advantage in making prevention, because you are treated exactly in the same way. Okay? So, let me first introduce simple and straightforward observations about this egalitarian allocation. Well, first of all, this egalitarian allocation, I have introduced it as the outcome of some uniform insurance pricing that could be reached through differentiated lump sum taxes and lump sum subsidies. But of course, this is completely equivalent to prohibiting any categorical discrimination in insurance pricing. If you prohibit any categorical discrimination, well, that means that insurance firms are supposed to charge the same price for any individuals. And of course, if all individuals purchase insurance, then of course the common price for everybody will be P star. So needless to introduce this complex transfer system, you just have to prohibit any categorical discrimination and then you will get the same result. Or you may forget insurance and just assume that you have a state-funded assistance scheme without any role for the private insurance sector. So this is the first remark. The second remark is the fact that, well, if you are in this egalitarian allocation through some uniform insurance pricing, well, it's likely that people who are living in low-risk area, they may prefer not to purchase any insurance. Well, because they are low risk, you can easily compute what I write here, what I defined here as P max, as the maximum premium that people who are living in low risk areas, they would accept to pay to be covered. Okay, well, this is just given by this equation. On the left hand side here, you have the expected utility of an individual who is living in a low risk area. So you see his risk probability of disaster is pi L. If one minus pi L, I have no disaster. Pi L, I have a disaster. I suffer disaster. My wealth in the first case is W, in the other one is W minus A, and this is my expected utility. Well, this is equivalent to pay, to be fully covered and to pay a given premium, P max. And it's likely that P max will be lower than P star, which means that people who are living in low-risk areas, they would prefer not to be covered by any insurance coverage rather than paying this P star, in fact. Which means that the viability of the uniform pricing, well, regime probably requires, in fact, that insurance is compulsory. And by the way, if I take the French case, this is the case. This is actually the case. Natural disaster insurance is, in fact, compulsory. And the third observation, I have already done it, so just a repetition, the fact that, of course, it's never optimal to implement, well, to make any prevention effort in this framework, in this situation, for obvious reasons. So let's keep with the idea that natural disaster will be obligatory, but let's introduce some degree of categorical discrimination, okay? And well, suppose that people who are living in high-risk areas, they pay a premium PH, and people who are living in low-risk, they pay PL. When do an individual living in a high-risk area will decide to move to a low-risk area, or let's say to make any prevention decision? In practice, that may correspond to other thing than moving physically to another area. We consider other concrete decisions that would correspond to going from a high-risk situation to a low-risk situation. Well, it's easy to check that he will do it if its prevention cost is lower than the difference between the two level of premium. If moving to the low risk area would allow him to benefit from a lower insurance price, and this difference, this decrease in its insurance price, will be larger than the cost he will incur to make this prevention. Okay, which means that it's clear that the prevention cost, C, should not be, for an individual, should not be too large for him to be optimal, well, to make prevention. If he is incurring too large prevention costs, he would prefer not to move to a low-risk area. So, in fact, there is a threshold which is easy to compute, and one line of computation, useless to do it. Well, it's easy to check to compute this threshold, which is denoted here by C star, which is a threshold of the prevention cost, such that when you have a prevention cost which is under C star, then it's optimal for you to make prevention. And when your prevention cost is larger than C star, it's better not to do it. Okay? What is important to check here is that this threshold C star, in fact, is decreasing with the sum TL plus TH. Well, keep in mind that TH and TL, these are the lump sum subsidies and the lump sum taxes, which are either paid or levied according to the risk type, the risk type of or the area where the individual is living. So where TL plus TH is increasing, then you have more redistribution between the two areas, and this threshold is decreasing. You have a minus sign here. So when TL plus TH is increasing, there is less incentive to prevention, and the threshold C star is decreasing. And the when the subgroup of people who decide to move to low risk areas is shrinking. Okay. Well, once you have compute, and by the way, you can check that if you take TL equal to TL star and TH equal to TH star, TL star and TH star corresponded to the egalitarian allocation that we have defined before. So when you have these two redistributive parameters which correspond to the egalitarian allocation, then in that case you can check that C star is equal to zero. There is no, the subgroup of people who decide to make prevention vanish completely, in fact. Well, you can, when C star is positive, then you can check the you can define the proportion of individuals who are in low risk areas. They are first of all, of course, 1 minus lambda that correspond to people who were initially already living in low risk areas, and also those people who were initially living in high risk area, they were in proportion lambda, and whose prevention cost C was lower than C star, so they decided to move to the low risk area. And the proportion of these individuals is equal to F of C star. F is the cumulative distribution function of C, so F of C star is the proportion of people living initially in high-risk areas who decide to move to low-risk areas. Okay? We can also compute, I would say, the efficient threshold. The efficient threshold, because it's never optimal from a social I would say social efficiency point of view, it's never optimal for everybody to move from a high risk area to a low risk area. You may be living in a high risk area, but it's so important for you, for any reason you can imagine, that your prevention costs would be so large that moving to a low risk area would entail such large costs that would be inefficient even from a social efficiency point of view. So you can compute the threshold C double star for which it's efficient to move to the low risk area when C is lower than C double star, and it's not efficient to do it where C is larger. And it's obvious, well, the value is written here, but it's very easy to understand what is this C double star. Well, it's just equal to the difference between, well, the actuarial cost of natural disaster in high risk and low risk area. In high risk area, it's PHA, and in low risk, it's PLA. So when your own prevention cost is larger than this difference between the social cost of natural disaster in both areas, so it's better for you, even from a social efficiency point of view, to remain where you are living. But what is much more important is to see that C star is lower than C double star. As soon as there is some redistribution between the two risk areas, as soon as TL or TH are positive. Immediately, as soon as you introduce this, cross-subsidization between the two areas, then in that case, you have some distortion, in fact, in prevention because of these compensatory tax subsidies. Well, so cross-subsidization corresponds to TL or TH, and in fact, TL and TH positive, and this cross-subsidization entails some inefficiency in prevention decisions. Well, we can then have a look at conditions for a tax subsidy scheme to be Pareto improving. What do I mean by Pareto improving? Probably a terminology which is familiar to many of you, but not for everybody. I mean, by Pareto improving, that it's better for everybody. It's improving, it improves the situation of people who are living in low risk, and it's improving the situation for people who are living in high risk areas. So Pareto improving here means improving the situation of everybody. Well, what are the conditions for a tax subsidy scheme to be Pareto improving when we start from the status quo situation, where from the egalitarian status quo situation where all individuals pay P-star? Well, first of all, people who are still living in high-risk areas, well, their situation should not deteriorate, which means that their premium should not be larger. And this is equivalent to say that they should receive at least the same subsidy. Individuals who are already living in a low-risk area, they should not be penalized either. So their premium should not increase neither, which means that the tax which is levied on their insurance contract should not increase. And thirdly, well, of course, a feasibility constraint, the government budget constraint should still be satisfied. But here, of course, the government budget constraint includes the fact that now the proportion of people who are living in low risk, and so these people that are paying the tax TL, it's no more only 1 minus lambda, is 1 minus lambda plus lambda F of C star. It includes the proportion of people who have made some prevention, okay? And on the other side here, on the left-hand side, we have the proportion of people who have decided not to make prevention because they were incurring too high prevention cost. And this proportion is equal to 1 minus F of C star. This is the proportion of people who are living in high-risk areas with a prevention cost larger than C star. Well, you can use this, let's say, the definition of the equilibrium, in fact, to characterize the equilibrium with two parameters, in fact, with three. Well, let's say one parameter and two unknown, if you want. The first parameter is denoted by K. What is K? Well, K, as written here, it is the increase in the insurance subsidy in high-risk areas by comparison with the egalitarian allocation. Well, egalitarian allocation provides TH star, so TH is equal to TH star plus K. So we may start with K equal to zero, which means that, well, we don't want to make the situation of people who are living in high-risk areas better, but we don't want to make it worse neither. So let's take K equal to zero for a few moments. So now we can describe what is going to occur with two variables, in fact. These variables are C star, the threshold of prevention cost, and TL, the tax that should be leveled in low-risk areas. Well, we first have a migration equilibrium condition. Well, to see what is the meaning of this migration equilibrium condition, which is denoted by ME here, just look at this equation here. Well, keep K equal to zero, as I said before. So that means that, well, if you want more prevention, that means if you want C star to be larger, okay? If you want more prevention, you want the threshold for prevention cost to be larger, then you need to have a lower tax. So you need tax cuts in low-risk areas to attract people to move to low-risk areas. So in fact, increasing C star, okay, increasing the threshold of prevention cost is possible only if you induce more tax cuts in low-risk areas. So when C star is increasing, there is a minus sign here, TL should be decreasing. And $1, in fact, a $1 increase in C star should be reflected in a $1 decrease in TL. So in the C star TL plane, as I will show it in a minute, so that will be this migration equilibrium condition will be described by a decreasing straight line. And you also have the government budget constraint, which is the same as before. I have written it. I've written it like that because I'm going to illustrate it on this C star T in this C star TL plane. So I write it as TL as a function of C star with k equal to zero for simplicity, and that means that well, just multiply TL by the denominator here, you get the amount of taxes that are levied in low risk areas, and multiply lambda. Multiply by 1 minus FC star, multiply by TH star, you get the subsidies that have to be paid in high-risk areas. So this is the government budget constraint. And this is decreasing. This is a nonlinear function. TL is a nonlinear function of C star. It is decreasing. Why is it decreasing? Because if you are able to attract more people in low-risk areas, so there will be, of course, less people in high-risk areas, so you will have to pay less subsidies, and you will be able to get higher resources because there will be more people in low-risk areas. So in a sense, the government budget constraint will be relaxed. Okay? So these two constraints correspond to an equilibrium, and this is illustrated in this figure where C star is on the horizontal line and TL is on the vertical line. Okay? So just focus on the bold lines. The bold lines, this one here, and this curve here. This bold straight line, starting from point A here, correspond to the migration equilibrium. That's denoted by ME for migration equilibrium. This is what I said before when I said that $1 more in terms of threshold for prevention cost should be sustained by $1 less in taxes levied in low-risk areas. So when C star is increasing, TL should decrease, and the slope here is equal to minus 1. And you have also this government budget constraint, GBC here, which starts here from point A. What is point A? Point A is the egalitarian solution, the situation where you have TL equal T star and C star equal to 0. Okay? But this slope, this curve is decreasing. Well, it is decreasing, and it is nonlinear, and it is decreasing for the reason I mentioned before. Because if you are able to attract more people in low-risk areas, and I repeat, there will be less people in high-risk areas, you will have less subsidies to pay to people who are living in high-risk areas, and so it will be easier for you to levy the same amount of taxes in low-risk areas because there will be more people there. So that will be decreasing. And we see that if it is decreasing with a slope here lower than 1, that starts from A like that. This is not necessarily convex as I have drawn here, but this convexity is not important. This is, suppose that, and I will look at when it is true in a few seconds, suppose that this is decreasing like that with a slope here lower than minus 1, in fact. So you see that there is another equilibrium where the two lines are crossing. Of course, there is a first possible situation, which is the egalitarian situation, but there is another one here which is much more favorable, which is point C here, where you have C0 star, which is positive, where you have a positive threshold for prevention, so an amount, positive amount of prevention, and you have lower taxes, which are denoted here by TL0 in low-risk areas, which means that among these two equilibriums, this one dominates in the sense of Pareto, as I said before, Pareto dominates point A. Everybody is better here than here. People who are living in high-risk areas have taken K equal to zero, so their situation has not changed. And people who are living in low-risk areas, their situation has improved because they enjoy tax cuts. Okay, and these tax cuts have induced some prevention, and this prevention have relaxed the government budget constraint, and it has allowed us to reach this, better equilibrium. Well, when k is increasing, which means then when we want to treat better and better people who are living in high-risk areas, well, it's easy to see, to check that the migration equilibrium is shifting downward like this straight line. and the government budget constraint is moving upwards. So you go from C to E, for example, and finally to F. So you move from an equilibrium where you have a lot of prevention here to equilibrium where you have less and less prevention till C1 star, and less tax cuts, of course. So in fact, you are going to induce less and less prevention, but people who are living in high risk are in a better situation because K is increasing, and people who are living in low risk, they are in worse situation because they are enjoying lower and lower tax cuts. So in fact, you have some kind of trade-off, which is a trade-off between equity and efficiency, which can be described, in fact, by this figure, where the situation of people in terms of final wealth is described, and their final wealth depends on their prevention cost. Well, here you have the threshold, which is efficient, C double star, and we can never reach it. We can go from C0 star to C1 star. C0 star, well, it's what we do when we choose K equal to zero. And in that case, well, all people who are not making any prevention because their prevention cost is too large, well, they are maintained at their initial status quo situation. And all the other people, they are enjoying better and better final wealth because they enjoy tax cuts. And of course, the individuals who are in the best possible situation correspond to people with C is equal to zero, either because they were already living in low-risk areas or because their prevention cost was equal to zero. Anyway, if we want to treat in better and better people who are living in high-risk area, we increase K, okay? So we move in that direction, and then we shrink the interval zero C star, inducing less and less prevention, as we have seen before. Hence, this equity efficiency trade-off. Well, I come back to an important point, is whether or not the situation which is described in this figure is true. That means whether, well, this curve here starts with a slope larger than -1, and whether it is possible to have this situation. Well, you make a small computation, and you get a condition, which is written here, which by itself is unimportant, but which tells that this condition will be satisfied for, I would say, natural reasons, intuitive reason. We need the fraction of individuals in risky areas to be large enough, so lambda should be large. But, well, there should be a substantial number of people among these individuals with low prevention costs. So F of zero, F is the density, so the density function for C to be low in the neighborhood of zero should be large enough, let's say. So it's intuitive. When you have a lot of people living in high-risk areas with low prevention costs, well, it's understandable that you can provide incentives easily and get a lot of advantage from these incentives. So this natural condition for existence of trade-off is natural. It's something quite intuitive. But what is more important is to see how we can improve the situation, when we can make it more likely to occur, and that's why what I had in mind when I said that we should improve the trade-off. Well, to improve the trade-off, we may introduce some categorical discrimination. That can be done in at least in two ways. First thing we can do, we can categorize individuals. And secondly, we can categorize risk areas. Well, we can categorize individuals. For example, we suppose that people are living in groups which are observable and indexed by I, let's say going from 1 to N. And well, we condition all the parameters of the model by I. Okay, so it's useless to enter into the notations, just to have in mind that we have various individuals who are characterized by some observable features. For example, for flood insurance, we may separate new and old buildings. We may separate regions according to frequency of floods. For crop insurance, we may categorize farms according to the type of plants they grow, to their location, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So everything can be categorized, which means that we may add index I going from 1 to N on all our parameters. And of course, then we will have a prevention threshold C star, which now is written CI star, which is type dependent. Okay? And of course, we will have the government budget constraints, which will aggregate all the subsidies and all the taxes. And it's easy to check that, well, of course, this condition for the possibility of a Pareto dominant equilibrium with a positive amount of prevention, it may hold for some subgroup and not for the other ones, which means that this condition here is just the same as the ones that we have introduced before here, the condition of validity for this Pareto dominating equilibrium, that may hold for some I and not for the other ones. For example, suppose just to as a matter of illustration, suppose that the proportion of I risk is the same for all groups, so the lambda I are all the same, all equal to lambda, but you have some individuals, let's say for example, take the case of that I took as an example, as an introductory example, just consider for flood insurance, old buildings and new buildings. So it's likely that the prevention costs are distributed not in the same way for the two groups. And then on average, let's say on average, from the point of view of the distribution of prevention costs are lower for new buildings than they are for old buildings. So in that case, if the distribution of prevention cost for group I dominates group G in the sense of first order stochastic dominance, well then you should focus only, there is a threshold among all the groups which is denoted by I star, and all groups under I star, it's optimal to develop tax cuts and specific subsidies for these individuals, why it would not be optimal to do it for the other ones. Well, we may also trade off low-risk areas. And, the reason for which you can improve the trade-off by categorizing low-risk areas is the following. When here, the question is when you make prevention, you move from a high risk to a low risk area. But in fact, of course, it's quite intuitive to take the case of flood insurance, for example, that what is important, if you imagine a river where people living around the river, and this is a high risk area, and all the other areas are supposed to be low risk areas. Of course, what is much more important is to try to attract and to succeed in attracting people who are living in the high risk areas, let's say, to move 3 kilometers away from the river. Not far from the river, because for them it would be much less costly to move 5 or 10 kilometers from the river where there will not be any flood. And it's not important and probably much more difficult to attract them 300 kilometers from the river. In terms of probability, it's much more natural to do that. In terms of what is costly and what is not costly to do. So in fact, it would be much more important, in fact, to target the tax cuts in the part of the low-risk area which are not far from the high-risk area, and not to target any tax cuts in the regions which are low-risk but which are far from the high-risk. Okay, and this is group one, which is supposed to be located near high-risk areas, and other are group two. And we suppose that there is a fraction of individuals which is denoted by mu that are living in low-risk areas in group one and a fraction one minus mu in group two. And when you shrink the low-risk area in group one, which means when you decrease mu, well, in fact, you make the tax cuts much more effective in the sense that it's much less costly to the budget, to the government budget, in fact, because you don't enter any tax cuts for people, for areas, where probably people would not think they are going to move, in fact. And when you are doing that, well, what you can show is that, well, you are able to relax, in fact, the government budget constraint, which is quite intuitive, in fact, which means that here, This is the tax, the new tax. In fact, the tax cost in the low risk area in group one, and then in group two we forget it. And inducing it, well, you, we can when the proportion of people who are living in this targeted low risk area is shrinking, then the cost of the budget is lowering, and then when you can do it, well, the government budget constraint line is moving and shifting down, downwards, which means that you can reach a better equilibrium with more prevention and more tax cuts in these specific areas. Well, we can make a very simple calibration just to try to persuade you that this is completely, it is something relatively, I would say, realistic. Just very simplistic, in fact. And calculation, well, assume, consider flood insurance for new buildings, make some simple insurance, suppose that lambda is equal to 5%. So there are, suppose that there are 5% people who are living in flood-prone areas, and 95% who are living in other regions where a flood is possible but much unlikely. We target, and we suppose that we are able to do it, 10% part of the low-risk area, so mu is equal to 0.10, where we are targeting tax cuts, and pH is 10%, so your probability of a flood when you are living in a risk-prone area is 10%, but it's only 2% if you are in low-risk areas. So we suppose that C is uniformly distributed over this interval, well, where C upper bar is the average prevention cost for new building. Well, so which means that I write C upper bar as, well, as the product of the discount rate and the additional investment cost, which is denoted by I, which you will entail if you move from a high risk to a low risk. And then you make the computation and you find that for this Pareto improving situation to be possible, so for targeted tax cuts to be Pareto improving and to improve the trade-off, you just need to have this inequation to hold. And well, this inequation puts an upper value, which depends on all the parameters, of course, on this ratio between this additional cost and the loss. For example, if you take R equal to 3%, well, interest rate equal to 3%, you get I divided by A that should be lower than 70%, which means that the increase in cost when you move, in fact, from a high risk to a targeted low risk should be lower than 70% of the possible of the value of your home if it is fully destroyed by a flood for this Pareto improvement to be feasible. Well, of course, this is just an illustration just to say that, well, that makes sense. In fact, this idea of targeting some low-risk areas where you want to attract people from high-risk areas. Well, last thing in this presentation, the prevention by communities. I've only focused on the prevention by individuals, but as I've said, well, prevention by communities, in practice, is quite important, of course, and I mainly would like to emphasize the fact that there is some complementarity between the incentives that we can provide to communities for prevention and the incentives that we can provide to individuals. Well, needless to enter modeling, just imagine that you have your country where you have a number of communities which are indexed by G, and there are a fraction of people which is denoted by beta J, which is belonging to community G, and all the parameters are indexed by J according to the community where you are living in, which you are belonging to. Well, we can compare, in fact, prevention decisions that could be made, that could be optimal, socially optimal. By socially optimal, I mean from the point of view of the maximization of the expected wealth per inhabitant. and the prevention decisions that will be actually made by the community. Here, I suppose that, community G, it's a very schematic way of describing risk management by community. I just assume that community G can surprise the high-risk areas within its jurisdiction by incurring some cost, okay? And this cost is denoted by theta G for community G. So spending theta J in community J allows people who are living in this community to escape from, to be transformed. It allows people who are living in this community to become a low risk individual. While initially some of them were high risk. So we can first of all consider what is optimal from a social point of view. Well, just have to compare this, this big equation, it's not very important to look at it precisely. It's just what is aggregate expected wealth per inhabitant when people do the right amount of prevention. The threshold is equal to C double star, as we have seen before. Well, this is the expected wealth. This is the initial wealth minus the wealth for people who will live in low risk minus the wealth for people who are living in high risk minus the prevention cost. In fact, for people who do actually prevention because C is between zero and C double star. And well, it's optimal for a community, from the point of view of the maximization of expected wealth of their members, in fact, to make this prevention plan, this risk management plan, if this is larger than this new value, which corresponds to its new expected wealth per inhabitant, where all people now they are low risk, but of course they have to suffer this theta J, which is probably distributed among them through local taxation. Well, and then you see easily by very straightforward computation that you get an upper value for theta J. Well, and where theta J is lower than this upper value, well, it's optimal to do it. And when theta J is larger, you should not do it. Well, now we oppose this decision, which is socially optimal, to what will be the true decision by local communities. Well, you do the same, but now you replace the cost for people who are living in low risk and people who are living in high risk, which was the actuarial cost before here. We replace it by the cost that people actually pay through their premium, okay? And you do the same thing. And you check that, of course, with a threshold for prevention, which is C star. And we find that there is an interval of values for theta J, where it should be optimal to do it, but the local community will not do it. And it will not do it because it will not have the right incentive to do it. What are the incentives of a community? The incentive of a community are the incentive of its members. And the members of the community, here the community is supposed to maximize the expected wealth of its members. Of course, we could have a more satisfactory way of describing the way a community makes its decision. But if we keep with this very simple way of describing decision within the community, community will make the decision. I say it one more time, if it's optimal for its member to do it. And if there is some distortion because of cross-subsidization for local decisions, for individual decisions, there will be distortion for communities. And, just to finish, because I think time is almost over, what can be done? We can redraw one more time these migration equilibrium and government budget constraint curves in the C star TL plane, okay? Well, the migration equilibrium has not changed. What is GBC here? Well, GBC is just the government budget constraint if there were never any prevention plan enforced by local community. If we make it possible for community to you have these two equilibrium here, as we have seen before. Now, if we add the possibility for community to make this prevention plan with some distortion, as we said, well, if we are here, keep in mind that A is an egalitarian allocation without any prevention. C star is equal to zero, and TL is TL star. Well, there is such an amount of distortion that the community have no incentive for prevention, in fact, and that will not change anything. But as soon as C star is positive, because there is some incentive which have been provided to individuals, then there is also incentive for communities. And the curve is the GBC curve is moving downwards as a new curve, GBC prime curve, which corresponds to the new government budget constraint equilibrium, taking into account the fact that the community now they have incentive because their members have incentives. And finally, we can add something which corresponds to the possibility for the government to subsidize local decisions. Of course, this is a cost for the federal government. And this is something which enters, of course, the government budget constraint. But at the same time, it's also a way to provide more incentive for community to develop this local decisions. And it can be shown that, under some mild condition, I would say, that this curve shifts downwards a little bit more, leading to even more decision and even more prevention. And in that sense, there is this complementarity between incentives to individuals, which correspond to the C star, the threshold for prevention, and incentives to communities. Well, let me just finish by summarizing some brief conclusions. Well, this equity efficiency trade-off, where does it come from? I've tried to convince you that its source is mainly in the imperfect information of the regulator. Anything you can do, you can do only by relying on some observable information, categorizing individual according to some signals, categorizing risk areas. That's what you can do. You cannot rely on individual prevention costs. You cannot observe it, and that's the source of a trade-off between the equity objective and the efficiency objective. Well, I've said in the introduction, you can develop the same logic for mitigation. Well, third point is I try to develop a model where the main outcome is the fact that you can implement an adequate transfer schedule, some cross-subsidization between risk areas, where you can reach a new equilibrium with some prevention without, in fact, without creating damages for people who are still living in high risk areas because they cannot escape because their prevention cost is too high. So the fourth point is, this idea of categorization, which, as I said, probably quite important and maybe the most important thing for people working with actuarial computation in mind. And finally, the fact that cross-subsidization induces distortions in local decision-making, in individual decision-making, but also in decision-making by communities, and that's the reason why there is some kind of positive externality to provide additional incentive to local communities to make this prevention to make their prevention decisions, and that's the reason why there is some, I would say, good reason for implementing, let's say, conditional grants by a federal government to local communities to induce more prevention through these risk management plans. Thank you.
we switch to the best results get deserved. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.